Good afternoon, I'm John Stewart. It's Wednesday, June 5th. Thank you for listening to FM 99.5 KKLA. We're here live Monday through Friday, 4 o'clock to 7, as we deal with the issues head on. God. Well, the Bible begins with, in the beginning, God. And the Bible says twice in the Psalms, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. But why are there so many agnostics and atheists if God's existence is so evident? There may be many explanations, but there are certain arguments consistently raised by skeptics which call into question God's existence. Coming up, we'll discuss atheism and the case against God with atheist George Smith and Christian apologist Greg Bahnsen. God exists. Well, that's a question people have been pondering for centuries. And, of course, the Bible begins with the assumption there is a God and says the fool has said in his heart there is no God. But how do we explain the atheists around us and the agnostics? Is there some common thread of concern or criticism that exists there? And we're going to talk about that now. We're going to talk about atheism. My guest, George Smith, has written two books. One is entitled Atheism, the Case Against God. The other, Atheism, Ayn Rand, and Other Heresies. And George first published Atheism, the Case Against God in 1974. The book is still in print, published by, I think it's Prometheus. That actually is Prometheus. And then for 6 years, he was a general editor and scriptwriter for the Audio Classics, audio tapes by Knowledge Product. Currently, senior research fellow for the Institute for Humane Studies at George Mason University. And again, his latest book, Atheism, Ayn Rand, and Other Heresies. George Smith, we welcome you to the program.
Thank you.
I'm going to get a little closer to the mic there, George. Also, we have Dr. Greg Bahnsen, presently scholar in residence at the Southern California Center for Christian Studies, an author of 5 books and nearly 100 journal or periodical articles in Christian apologetics, ethics, and theology. His doctorate is in philosophy, the area of knowledge or epistemology from the University of California, and he has degrees from Westminster Theological Seminary. And Dr. Greg Bahnsen, we welcome you as well.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with George Smith. The status quo is existence of God. Most people would believe in that. So since you are sort of opting to challenge the status quo, let's start with your background, George, in the case against God. Give us your background. You know, why don't you believe there is a God?
Well, first of all, let's be clear about what the definition of atheism is, as used by most atheists. Atheism is simply the absence or lack of belief in a God. So if to the question, do you believe in a God, you answer no, that makes you an atheist. I don't believe in a God primarily because I don't see any good reason why I should. In other words, the burden of proof in my mind clearly falls on the theist or the God believer, first to define what he's talking about when he uses the term God, and secondly, then to provide arguments or proof of some kind that such a being exists.
And what type of proof are we talking about? Apodictic certainty? You're talking about the preponderance of evidence? What would you accept as sufficient proof to have you change your point of view?
Well, it depends on the kind of being that is defined. I mean, it seems to me we require stronger evidence or proof of certain things than we do others, especially when something is so out of our context of ordinary experience. For example, it seems to me that if someone claims to have seen a man rise from the dead, we're going to require a fairly strong degree of proof to accept that assertion. I think the problem, though, with theists, as I have encountered them, is not in the area of proof. It's that they stumble at the first, because providing some kind of coherent description, if not a definition, of what kind of being they have in mind when they describe God. A description that's not utterly unintelligible, or at least is not contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem I have. In many cases, when I ask people, what do you mean by God, I don't get any answer that makes much sense to me. They might as well say, I believe in a blark.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nonsense word in that mm-hmm. sense, in my mind.
George, when we talk about, you know, your working definition that you don't see any evidence for God or sufficient evidence for God, there are shades of definitions here of agnostic and mm-hmm. atheist. So you're just using loosely the term atheist to describe those that have never seen enough evidence for God.
They simply do not believe in a God. And I, admittedly, since I'm using the term God, I should provide at least a rough estimate of what I mean when I use the term. A God, for me, generally speaking, has to be some kind of a supernatural, or if you like, transcendent being. In my mind, I'd reject any naturalistic concept of God. In other words, if somebody says to me, I believe that nature is God, I say, fine, but why call it God? Why not just call it nature?
Mm-hmm.
So at least the minimum requirement has to be that it's some kind of being that transcends or falls outside the natural context of the nature, falls outside natural law. So a God presumably can perform miracles, do mm-hmm. things that natural creatures cannot.
But apparently by your presence here, you're open to discuss it as if enough evidence were adduced, you would be willing to modify your perspective.
Yeah, and I've been asked before the question, what would it take to convince me? Well, not to be too flippant about it, but I suppose in a Monty Python-like manner, you know, the clouds were to open and a giant hand were to come down from the clouds and grab me by the scruff of the neck and shake me and say, I'm here, I'm here.
That would do it for most people.
Yeah, that would get me thinking.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I ask these is to try to, from my own understanding, determine whether you would fall into the category of what I would call a soft-boiled or a hard-boiled agnostic, or somebody that at least is open to discuss it, or you've totally ruled out any possibility of God's existence.
Well, again, until someone tells me what they mean by God, I can't answer that question. It's like, do I rule out the possibility of life on other planets? I don't know. I mean, it depends on the arguments.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, I guess I'm open in principle. It's just that I've been an atheist for many years now and involved myself in a lot of debates, and I think I've heard most of the arguments I'm going to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So someone's going to have to come up with something new to convince me.
And just one more point before I bring Greg Bonson into this, but in terms of background, and I don't mean to get ad hominem, but I mean, did you have any type of religious training?
I considered myself a fundamentalist Christian until about a sophomore in high school. I was devoutly religious. I had many what I called religious experiences. My family was not especially religious, but I was. I prayed. I worked in church services. I got my God and Country merit badge in the Boy Scouts. I was a model Christian child by all indications, and things happened. I discussed that in my latest book.
Mm-hmm.
There's an essay called My Path to Atheism,
mm-hmm.
where I go through the deconversion process,
mm-hmm.
as I call it.
And when you say you were religious, did you consider a personal relationship with Jesus Christ part of what you had?
Yes, very much so.
Because some people would make a differentiation between religion and relationship.
Well, I was raised on Air Force bases. The churches were technically non-denominational, but
mm-hmm.
my experience was, so I can't say it was Baptist or any particular theology. But I consider myself a fundamentalist.
Mm-hmm.
I accepted what I consider to be a literal belief in the Bible, etc.
Bonson, you're a doctor from USC in epistemology, and as a Christian theologian, of course, you have done many debates and written in the area of God's existence. Where does one begin in presenting evidence for God? How would you approach George Smith, for example?
Well, I appreciate about George, I've only met him this afternoon, but I appreciate about his writings that he understands how important epistemology is to the whole discussion. If we're going to talk about the existence of God, we're not going to want it to reduce to a question of emotion or just volitional commitment of some sort without man's intellect being engaged. And I think he's right about that. As Christians, we do not give up our intellect when we believe in God or follow the Scriptures. And so, since the issue is epistemology, this may not be what many of your hearers would like to get into, perhaps, but we need to talk about what amounts to proof and what amounts to knowledge and how these things are possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that we have to be extremely critical. I know that Christians often have the reputation for not being critically minded, and I think that's probably a failing on our part when we're like that. But if we're going to be critically minded, we need to examine the presuppositions of our thinking. And we have to look at the worldview that we're espousing when we argue in a particular way or not. And so if I were, talking with George over coffee, I think I would probably talk to him, first of all, about what outlook he has on the world. What does he conceive reality to be? How does he know what he knows? How should he live his life? And I would compare that to the Christian worldview, what we understand to be reality and how we know what we know and how we should live our lives. And then, of course, we're going to have to eventually get to the point of deciding how does one choose one worldview over another. At some point, maybe after two or three cups of coffee, I would eventually challenge George that on an atheist worldview, the presuppositions of atheism do not provide a foundation for proving anything whatsoever. And therefore, in one sense, the strongest evidence and argument for the existence of God is that without a belief in God, you can't prove anything. And so I would make that the foundation for reason. Often, and I think you'll see this if you read George's book, you have people who present something of a Thomistic approach to faith and reason, where faith fills in the gaps where reason lets us down or is inadequate. My own theological perspective is more Augustinian rather than Thomistic, and I would argue instead that everything we do engages the reason as a tool of man's intellect, but that the cogent use of reason is impossible apart from the foundation of faith. And you see, I would preach that to my Christian brothers and sisters. They need to, read the Scriptures and use their minds and not simply have an emotional Christianity, But that would also be the premise that I would approach an atheist or an unbeliever with. I'd say that the best use of reason, in fact, the only use of reason, comes about when Christian faith is the foundation for it, or the worldview in terms of which you use your reason.
But, Greg, you wouldn't defer to faith as being some mystical faculty or credulity. You're talking about a belief based upon evidence, then.
Yes. There have been plenty of Christians throughout history that have taken that mystical approach to faith. They've defined it as a second approach to knowledge apart from man's reason and so forth. But I think those are misguided.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that faith is essentially a belief. And the reason we talk about faith and reason is because when we have faith, it means we are trusting somebody else's expertise in some area. In that sense, the student at the university who first hears lectures about U.S. history or about logic or what have you begins to learn about these fields because he or she has faith in the instructor that they're giving them, you know, the straight scoop and that sort of thing. Christians have faith in another person. I mean, not apart from that, but in addition, we have faith in the person of God himself revealed in the scriptures. But I wouldn't say that that faith is apart from reason. I would say that engages the faculty of reason, and it is, in fact, the foundation for the use of reason.
So would proper reasoning lead you to believe in the existence of God?
I would argue that there isn't any proper reasoning apart from the foundation of belief in God.
Mm-hmm.
That apart from, it's not so much that it leads to belief in God, as belief in God is the necessary precondition for using man's reason at all.
Okay. George Smith, it sounds like there needs to be sort of an a priori understanding here to arrive at the proper conclusions. How does that fit into your thinking?
Well, there are several issues that were raised. I don't really understand exactly what Greg means when he talks about belief in God as a precondition for reason. He might mean that to prove the validity of reason, but he just said in order to even reason, you can't even do that without belief in God. I don't believe in a God, and yet I presumably reason. Maybe not to everyone's satisfaction, but I nonetheless do reason. As far as this idea of faith being trust in another, you know, there's nothing wrong with that use of faith. It's been used that way for many centuries, that if I take the word of somebody else that I have not personally witnessed, something for I've not personally witnessed, I'm having faith in it. But that kind of faith, presupposes you think the authority can himself prove what he believes in. In other words, I may take, quote, I may have, quote, faith in a physicist about some scientific experiment he's done. But that assumes that I believe the physicist himself is not acting from faith, but himself can prove what he says. So in that sense, I would say faith itself is dependent upon the assumption that somebody somewhere can prove what they're talking about. And I really don't understand this idea that reason itself, or to prove the validity of reason, we must have faith. It seems to me we're talking about two entirely different things.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me reason stands quite well on its own. I can talk about A is A, that's a self-evident truth. Where's the faith? I can talk about the table being in front of me. Now, if you want to say I have faith that the table's there, without getting to that kind of picayune sort of argument, I think that's absurd. I have direct physical contact with the table. It's quite obvious it's there. We have truths of mathematics. Where's the faith there?
Mm-hmm.
And you can extend that out and out. And reason, I think, and there are degrees of proof and so forth, but it seems to me reason is quite capable of vindicating itself.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. We'll come back and let Greg Bonson respond. So I want to talk about this area of evidence and where does faith fit in, where does evidence fit in, or what kind of evidence should we look for to come to the conclusion there is a God or that it's reasonable to believe in a supreme being. My guests are Greg Bonson and George Smith. We're talking about atheism and is there a case against God? Stay with us. We'll be right back. Does God exist? Well, most people listening would probably say yes, but what is the reason for you coming to that conclusion, the evidence? Some people think that God's existence is self-evident. The Bible nowhere attempts to more or less prove God exists, but assumes that he does and says it's foolish to do otherwise. Why are some people agnostic or atheist in their outlook? And that's what we're talking about. My guest, George Smith, has written the book Atheism, The Case Against God. And my other guest, Dr. Greg Bonson, a Christian apologist. Greg, let me go back to you and perhaps to respond to George's wondering, you know, does he lack reason because he doesn't begin with the premise of accepting God's existence? And then if you were to respond further to this whole area again, of what type of proof or evidence are we looking for that would make the case compelling to begin where you're beginning?
Yeah, I'm glad that George replied the way that he did because it allows for a clarification that I think we often overlook. Yeah, we take it for granted if we've studied philosophy, but often people don't see that there's a difference between talking about how you account for something and then what you're able to do, whether you can account for it or not. I can have tuberculosis and not be able to give you any idea of the medical facts and dynamics of tuberculosis. So there's a difference between doing something and being able to account for that, or for having something true about you and you not being able to account for it. And I wouldn't suggest for a moment that George Smith, for instance, doesn't reason. He does reason. He attempts to do that, and he attempts to do it consistently and so forth. But when he says to your audience, I reason, but I don't have faith in God, my response is, no, you do have faith in God. And one of the problems is, and this is why God would be unhappy with your life, George, is because you don't give him the credit that he deserves. You don't glorify him because your very ability to reason depends upon your knowledge of him and submission to him. Now, of course, George doesn't outwardly worship God. He doesn't go to a Christian church. He doesn't profess faith in Christ. He doesn't believe the Bible and those sorts of things. And I take him very seriously about that. But my challenge to him as a philosopher and as a fellow human being would be that at a deeper level, he does know this God that I'm talking about. The Apostle Paul in Romans 1 describes this as suppressing the truth by means of unrighteousness, that people can know God, and yet they don't outwardly profess it. And because they do know God, they are able to do things. They can balance their checkbook. They can drive a car. They can make sense out of human relationships and love. And they can reason. They are able to do that. But now, are they able to give an account of that? And that's where we get back to the whole question of the atheist worldview and the Christian worldview. In terms of the atheist worldview, I would challenge George that he cannot give an account of the reasoning that he's doing. An example that a seminary professor once used that stuck with me for many years, Dr. Van Til once said, there's no question that atheists count. Sometimes they count better than Christians. You know, they can do their math very well. They do count, but they cannot account for their counting.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in terms of their outlook on the world, what they profess to be true about knowledge and about reality, you know, the universals and absoluteness of mathematics would not make any sense whatsoever. And so I do agree that George does reason, but I would suggest that he cannot, in terms of his worldview, make sense of the reasoning that he engages in.
And Greg, has one clarification on that. Would that mean that all atheists are somehow unconscious theists?
Yes. I may want a more sophisticated way of describing that,
sure,
than unconscious, but that is generally what I'm
okay.
suggesting here, is that in their heart of hearts, they do know God, and they are rebelling against that knowledge by their outward profession and the way in which they attempt even to put together a rational worldview or appeal to reason, as George very well does. But you see, on his world, there is no reason to appeal to. I was thinking, if you don't mind, George, my quoting from your book for a moment. I just took one sentence that I thought would be a good point of departure for a conversation with you. In the introduction to your Atheism, the Case Against God, you say, to advocate irrationality is to advocate that which is destructive to human life. And you see, I read that sentence and I say, I agree with that. I think to advocate irrationality is a bad thing to do. That's not the way to go. I don't want Christians to understand faith in that way. And I agree with you that irrationality is destructive of human life. But now here's the interesting counter to that. Why, in an atheist worldview, shouldn't a person be irrational? You might say, well, because it's destructive of human life. But then the next question is, well, why shouldn't I be destructive of human life if I were an atheist? Now, you know why I don't believe in being destructive of human life. The question is, why did you put that in your book? Why does it bother you to be destructive of human life?
Well, before I get into that, I'd like to address a couple other things you said. First of all, there's a little bit of conversion by definition going on here. This idea that atheists are really somehow unconscious crypto-theists has been around a long time. Walter Kaufman, in a very good book called The Faith of a Heretic, talked about this problem and pointed out he was less than thrilled by the prospect. No matter how much you profess not to believe something, people say, well, you know, you really do believe it. I might just as well say that I'm sure I could derive a theory to justify it, that all Christians are really just atheists underneath and just don't realize it. And once they put away their childish things, they will realize they're atheists and so forth. I don't think that gets us anywhere. I'm not a crypto-theist, this business about justifying reasoning through faith in God strikes me as bizarre, because as an atheist once said, to explain the unknown by the known is a logical procedure. To explain the known by the unknown is a form of theological lunacy. I'm very familiar with the precepts of reasoning, rules of logic, etc. We don't need to drag faith in to explain these things or how we're able to do them. That's, by the way, how we're able to do it. That's more of a biological issue of evolution, the nature of consciousness, and so forth. But to be more specific, it seems to me that even if there is a problem there, to say God is responsible, well, we're dealing with this mysterious, vague notion of a God, and we're going to have faith in this thing, and how did God bring all this about? In other words, it seems to me we're dealing with something relatively simple and straightforward and can be dealt with through reason and philosophy, and the theologian comes along and says, I'm going to explain everything, and I'm going to explain it by positing an unknowable being who does things using some unknowable means, and there that clears up the problem. That, for me, simply compounds the problem. On top of philosophical problems we already have, we're adding this whole theological scene now, which also has to be explained. So I simply disagree. Now, do you want me to address your...
The destructive to human life, I'm interested in that as well. Why should it matter? You know, people are irrational, and that leads to destruction of human life. I mean, from an atheist perspective, so what?
You're getting into the issue of ethics, and that...
That same
book, a quarter of it, deals with the questions of ethics. Mm-hmm. Now, let me just first say one thing. I'm not alone on this. Now, I know that Greg says he's more from an Augustinian tradition rather than the Thomistic tradition. But the philosophers in the Thomistic tradition, and not just Catholics, those from that general background, they themselves admit that reason can discover certain precepts of natural law unaided by revelation. That God created the universe in a certain way, and this is called natural revelation. The deistic movement of the 18th century, or late 17th century, talked about this. As Greg Wells knows, there's different traditions here. Unlike Augustine, Aquinas held that although he believed in original sin, he did not hold this argument that original sin had corrupted man's reasoning ability to the extent that Augustine had. So he argued that even with original sin, it was still possible for human beings, through the use of reason, to discern certain natural laws. Now, certainly he thought they had to be aided and supplemented by revelation, but he held that reason was efficacious in that respect. So the atheist is not alone in holding that the precepts of morality, and if you understand what I mean by natural law ethics, that's traditionally what it's been called, the use of reason, investigating the nature of human beings, the nature of the environment in which we find ourselves, the nature of decision-making, you can arrive at general principles on how to live a good life. Now, as to the question, why should we care? Okay, that's a legitimate question. Because for me, happiness is the goal in itself. A good life is a goal in itself. I could put the same question to the Christian. Suppose God does exist. Why should we care? Because he tells us to care? What kind of basis is this for ethics? I mean, it puzzles me. It seems that a philosopher has to be concerned with rational arguments for an ethical system. Along comes the Christian and says, I have a basis for ethics. God will punish you if you do this, and he won't punish you and reward you if you do that. That sounds to me like a system of commandments. You know, do this or you don't. Where's the reason there? Is it right only because God wills it, or does God will it because it's right? That's a classic question. Is murder wrong only because God says it's wrong? If God tomorrow changed his mind and said, thou shalt not murder, would that make murder right? Or does God forbid murder because murder is intrinsically wrong? It seems to me that the Christian is caught on the horns of a dilemma. Either he has to take a hard line, it's wrong because God wills it to be wrong, in which case morality is reduced to a set of arbitrary decrees with no reason behind them, or he has to say that God himself forbids certain things because they are simply wrong, in which case there's a standard of morality apart from the will of God.
Okay, let's hold it there. A lot on the table. We'll take a break. We'll come back and let Greg Bonson respond. Talking about God and the existence of God, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to FM 99.5 KKLA. I'm John Stewart. We're here live Monday through Friday, 4 o'clock to 7, as we deal with the issues head on. The issue of the existence of God, one of the most fundamental questions one can ask, and what is the case against God? And that is the perspective of George Smith. His book is entitled Atheism, The Case Against God, and that's published by Prometheus. And along with him, Dr. Greg Bonson, a Christian apologist, philosopher, and author. And Greg, to address what George had just raised, why don't you just respond to him, perhaps, and people are just tuning in, they can figure out what's going on here.
Yeah, let me kind of catch the audience up here. I have suggested that Christians do not renounce the use of reason. They actually argue that reason cannot be intelligently utilized apart from the Christian worldview, and that therefore when we find atheists like George Smith trying to be reasonable using criteria for intelligibility and so forth, they are in fact acting like crypto-Christians. That is, they're working in terms of a Christian worldview, all the while denying what they know about God in their heart of hearts. And now George has responded to that, and I can understand why he would, that Well, now, you know, that may be just a kind of a version of name-calling. It's like, you say you're an atheist, but I say you're really not, so nya-nya-nya-nya-nya. And I can respond by, well, you say you're a Christian, I say you're an atheist, nya-nya-nya-nya-nya. But you see, that is not the nature of the claim here. If George believes that this is a reversible claim, then, of course, we need to engage in some rational combat here and talk about that. I would argue that the reason I say that he really does know God in his heart of hearts is because he gives evidence of depending upon the Christian worldview, even when he reasons against the Christian worldview. And I'm not going to do that right this minute, but just so you have some idea of what I'm talking about, if George appeals to moral absolutes, I'm going to say, well, that's the sort of thing that Christians do that makes sense if there's a God, but the moral absolutes that you appeal to in order to renounce belief in God, it doesn't make any sense in your worldview. Let me just finish here. And I think when you appeal to the use of scientific method and you assume the uniformity of nature, but of course on an atheist worldview you can't make sense out of the uniformity of nature, those are the sorts of things that we would end up talking about if I was going to show that, as a matter of fact, even his use of reason and moral argumentation presupposes what he's arguing against. Now, let's bring this back to our conversation. He has suggested, I could argue just the opposite with you, that as a matter of fact, what you're doing presupposes atheism. And to that, I would simply say, George, name that tune. Go ahead. If you think that you can show that I'm presupposing atheism, I'd like to see the argument for that. Because I wasn't just making an empty authority claim when I said you're presupposing the Christian worldview. I'm going to give you evidence that you're presupposing, and I'm going to show that you can't make sense of your reasoning and your morality apart from it. And what you need to do now is to show that I can't make sense of my Christian morality apart from the non-existence of God. That doesn't strike me as a very likely prospect for a philosopher to get to that conclusion, but I'd be open to that. It's not just a matter of name-calling and reversing authority claims here when we talk about the preconditions of intelligibility. Now, when it comes to morality, I need to move on quickly here. George has commented that even certain Christian theologians have said that natural law is a basis for a natural knowledge of at least some moral precepts, maybe not all that we need, but some fundamental ones. And to him, I would simply say, I would argue against those Christian theologians just as much as I would argue against him that natural law is not, in fact, a source for moral absolutes, that one cannot argue from what is the case, even the natural regularities that we see about us, to what ought to be the case. You can't move from a description of the world that we live in our experience to the way things ought to be. So he is right that some Christian traditions would be clear to him, but you see, my severe challenge to the atheist would remain, and I'd say I'd put the theologians who argue from natural law right over there, too, and I'd say, let's see if you can justify ethics based on that any better than George can, and I don't think they can. Now, is punishment the basis for Christian ethics? Suggestion was made that we believe that, say, murder is wrong because God has said so, and he will punish us if we don't agree. But that, of course, is not the Christian position at all. Did God forbid murder arbitrarily? This is the issue of voluntarism in theology. And the old conundrum from the days of Plato has supposedly been, well, if God does this simply on the basis of his sheer volition, he just wills murder to be wrong, then, of course, tomorrow he could will murder to be right. On the other hand, if God has some reason for willing murder to be wrong, then, of course, you don't need God in order to believe that murder is wrong, because the reason God has would be the basis. Well, what that overlooks completely is, from a Christian standpoint, God forbids murder because it's contrary to his own unchanging character. And God's volition, that is to say, his expressed will, saying, thou shalt not murder, is based upon who he is, the kind of God he is, and that is unchanging. And so the character of God is the basis of Christian morality, not simply the revelation of God or threats of eternal punishment if we should be murderers and so forth. When George says that happiness is a goal in itself. See, I would throw the voluntarist problem back on him at that point and say, well, George, even assuming, and I don't think this is correct, but just for argument's sake, assuming that on the basis of happiness as your telos or goal for living, that you could make sense of why you don't murder or why you try to be reasonable, I would still challenge you, why can't another individual freely say, well, I don't want to live for happiness, and I don't want to live for life-affirming values, and so forth. That is, in an atheist universe, there would be no absolutes at all. It would be everybody for himself, or, as Shakespeare put it, sound and fury signifying nothing.
George?
Okay, a lot of stuff there. I'll try to be brief. First of all, there's confusion here, and this goes back to Greg's original point. There is no atheistic worldview. Let's be straight about that. Atheism is simply the absence of belief in God. It does not by itself suggest or dictate any positive philosophy. There are a lot of atheists with a lot of different worldviews. Suppose, for example, that I don't believe in magic elves, which I don't, and let's call my disbelief a-elfism. It's as if Greg would say, well, a-elfism as a worldview doesn't explain anything. Well, I agree, it doesn't. It wasn't meant to explain anything. It's the absence of a belief. And I'm the first to admit that lacking a belief doesn't explain anything. It's the role of philosophy. After you're an atheist, you construct a positive philosophy, which may have no intrinsic relationship to your atheism per se. There are atheist existentialists. There are atheist Marxists. There are atheist advocates of Ayn Rand's objectivism. Atheism is, again, not a world view. And that's the basic confusion here. In that sense, I suppose the Christian worldview does explain more than the atheistic worldview, simply because even if a Christian worldview explains one thing, it's got it over atheism, because atheism isn't the worldview, and it wasn't meant to explain anything. So in that sense, I agree. As this stuff about, you know, God's unchanging character, let me just address the ethics thing. The problem with this is that it would take a lot of airtime and a lot of discussion to sit here and discuss the rational foundations of ethics. But as to, let me, so rather than do that,
how about
let me
a thumbnail sketch?
All right, well, I'd rather address one of the points first.
Okay.
This idea that somehow implicitly I show evidence of having a Christian, or not, maybe not Christian, but at least a belief in God, you know, did Christianity invent these things? Was Aristotle somehow a Christian at heart, even centuries before the time of Jesus? My view is Aristotelian, if it's anything. And unless we're going to argue that these pagan philosophers, by the way, that was an interesting question addressed by the early Greek apologists, to what extent the pagan or the Greek philosophers could have had true knowledge without knowledge of Christ. And they argued kind of that they thought that Moses got his wisdom from, some of the Greek philosophers had gotten their wisdom from Moses, and they went around in circles trying to justify how anyone who obviously were not Christians, because it was before the time of Christianity, could have received true knowledge. So I just think, I don't really know how to respond to that exactly. It seems to me that we're playing word games, essentially. There's nothing implicitly theistic about me saying A is A. And to take a very simple example, why does that evidence belief in God? A is a self-evident truth. The existence of God certainly isn't. It seems to me that A is much more evident than the existence of God is. Again, I don't see any reason there to suppose that we need to believe in God.
Well, let me suggest, first of all, that you're right that there is no one atheist worldview in the sense that all atheists agree with each other about epistemology and ethics and metaphysics. I was being general when I talked about the atheist worldview. But to state it more precisely, all we're saying is no particular atheist worldview can make sense out of reason, ethics, the sorts of things that are necessary for human life to make sense out of life. And so if you want to talk about existentialism, then we'll do that. If you want to talk about Aristotle, we'll take time to do that. What I'm saying is in each and every case, those who reject the worldview that I'm describing as biblical Christianity are not able to make sense out of proof and science and ethics and so forth. Atheism is not a generic name for a positive worldview, but there is no positive atheistic worldview where reason is even a necessity, much less something that can be made sense out of. Now, when George ends his last answer by saying A is self-evident, well, what I would say is go back and study logic. I mean, the law of identity has been rejected by some people. There are some worldviews, atheistic, non-Christian worldviews that don't agree. Well, now, look, I do agree with the law of identity. I believe in logic and so forth. But you see, I believe that I can make sense out of that because I am a Christian. That in a non-Christian worldview, there really isn't a reason why we couldn't deny the law of identity or come up with other kinds of what we might, I think you and I would agree, would be contradictory approaches to logic, but nevertheless are called logic in some worldviews.
Gentlemen, to jump in, we'll take a break and come right back. Coming up, we'll take your phone calls talking about atheism and God's existence. Your phone calls coming up at 1-800-331-KKLA. Toll free, 1-800-331-KKLA. Stay with us. You're listening to FM 99.5 KKLA. I'm John Stewart. We're here live Monday through Friday, 4 o'clock to 7, as we deal with the issues head on. We're talking about the existence of God. What is the proof? My guests are Greg Bahnsen, Christian apologist, and George Smith, atheist and author of the book Atheism, the Case Against God. Coming up, your phone calls at 1-800-331-KKLA. Before we go to the phones, Greg Bahnsen, you were sort of on a roll there. I think I cut you off prematurely. What were you about to say?
Well, I wanted to respond real quickly to George's good question. Was Aristotle a Christian at heart? And I'm going to bite the bullet and say, yes, he was. I don't mean by that, of course, anything like what the early Christians struggled with, whether Aristotle or Plato had learned about Moses and through Moses and so forth. We as Christians believe God has revealed himself in the natural order and through the conscience of man. We believe that all men know this God, even if they haven't had a biblical revelation of him. So in that sense, Aristotle had a Christian worldview in his heart of hearts, even if he didn't know about Moses or Christ, for that matter, in the same way that an Old Testament Jew would have been able to make sense out of reason and ethics and science because of the worldview provided to him by God in Revelation. In George's book, I noticed something, again, that I appreciated very much when he said that it's the responsibility of the philosopher to identify the underlying assumptions of commonly held beliefs. And I think on that note, he and I could have a very fruitful discussion trying to identify the underlying assumptions, say, of the scientific method. And if I can just throw that one out, I'd like to know how George would deal with this. We know that those who engage in the scientific method are able to extrapolate knowledge from the past into the future by assuming what's called induction. That is, that future cases will be like past cases, or in popular parlance, the uniformity of nature. Now, I know George believes in the procedures of science. I do too as a Christian. And the reason why I would rely upon the principle of induction is because I believe in a sovereign God who controls the universe. But it'd be interesting to know what underlying assumption George would have when he engages in the same scientific procedure as me. Is he using induction as a principle? And if so, why? Is that arbitrary?
George?
Well, my underlying assumption is that a thing is what it is. An existing thing has specific characteristics, and it's restricted to the range of behavior or action as defined by those characteristics. A cat will not give birth to baby elephants.
Why not?
Because that's the nature of the cat.
Well, that's begging the question to say it's the nature of the cat.
But you say
it's
the nature of God all the time. I can say it's the nature of the cat.
No, actually, I'm not just saying it's the nature of God. I'm saying God reveals himself to control the universe.
I'm saying my view of causation is that causation is essential to the law of identity applied to action. Things act as they do because they have specific determinate characteristics. And the physical or whatever nature of a existing thing determines the nature of the actions that thing can take. So when one billiard ball strikes another billiard ball, the nature of the billiard balls, the nature of the motion determines what the causal result will be. That's why we get down to the law of identity. There's regularity in nature because things are existing determinate things with specific characteristics.
Well, it's a tremendous philosophical mistake to assimilate the law of causality to the laws of logic. But if you study the history of philosophy, you'd know that this idea that things have a determinate nature and that's why they behave the way they do is associated with the conclusion that there can be no change. That is, it's impossible for things to change. Well, because the law of identity prevents them from changing. So now, I would continue the discussion. Let's look at our underlying assumptions. How is it possible to extrapolate into the future if you use the law of identity? There's no change to look at.
Let's assume that I'm wrong. Okay, I could refer you to books. H.W.B. Joseph's book on logic may be considered outdated. Fran Blanchard held a very similar view. It's been held. Richard Taylor holds a similar view. Okay, but let's assume that they're all wrong. And it's a minority view on the nature of causation, granted. But at least I'm trying to reach an explanation within the sphere of reason. In other words, it seems to me that my explanation, even if you don't accept it, makes a lot more sense than saying God does it. I mean, to me, that explains nothing. If you'd like to quote another line from my book, quote the line where I said the concept of God explains nothing. The reason I don't... When you've been talking to me about how can we explain this, how can we make sense of it, okay, I'm attempting to give an explanation. It may be an incorrect one, but it is within the realm of human understanding. I would challenge you to just tell me how God explains anything. Let's assume there is a problem. If I say, my explanation for that, let's make sense out of it. A blark did it. That's all I say. I would say to you, Greg, I'd say, you know, Greg, you really couldn't reason if it weren't for the existence of a blark. You'd be a little bit puzzled and say, what do you mean? I mean, you understand the problem here. So to me, if we're going to talk about explanation, right or wrong, it has to be within the realm of human understanding and human reason.
Sure.
If you simply plug in the word blark, or in your case, the word God, whenever you encounter a problem, it doesn't solve the problem. That is my fundamental point.
I understand. The fallacy here is the false analogy that when a person appeals to God, he's appealing to an undefined word like blark.
But you haven't defined it.
Oh, well, I'd be glad to do, though. We can open up the Bible. We can look to the Westminster Confession of Faith for a definition of God. I don't think you have any doubt that Christians have a definition of God.
They have many definitions.
Well, they do, and we're going to deal with the one that I hold to because I'm the one arguing today.
Yeah, good point.
But does appealing to God explain anything? Well, of course, when you ask philosophically, what is an explanation? The answer is, of course, it does. It may strike you as being easy as a Sunday school child's understanding, but if I've got a heavenly Father who created the entire universe and controls every detail, even to the hairs on my head, and I say of this creative personality who has this sovereign might and plan, that he sees to it that gravity holds on planet Earth day by day by day, that does in fact explain it, but it may not be the explanation that you want. I'm just talking about now what counts as an explanation. An explanation is something which enables you to predict the future and to account for why you predict it that way.
Okay, gentlemen, stand by. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll take your phone calls at 1-800-331-KKLA. Stay with us. You're listening to FM 99.5 KKLA. I'm John Stewart. We're here live Monday through Friday, 4 o'clock to 7, as we deal with the issues head on. We're talking about the existence of God with Dr. Greg Bahnsen and George Smith, author of the book Atheism, The Case Against God. Taking your phone calls, let's go to Benny, a first-time caller from Hawaiian Gardens. Benny, you're on KKLA.
Hi, John.
Hello.
My question is for Mr. Smith, and what I'd like to ask him is where does he believe life started or came from?
Where does life come from?
Okay, that question can be taken one of two ways, as a philosophical question or as a scientific question. I'm not a scientist, so my scientific answer, I don't know. By the way, if I can mention a book called The Blind Watchmaker by Richard Dawkins, which is, I think, one of the best books I've seen directly addressing this creationist argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very plausible book for people who might be skeptical about evolution. But it seems to me that what the caller might be getting at is the philosophical problem of the origin of life. Without going into all the problems there, and by the way, Dawkins does address them, let me say that philosophically, life is just one natural aspect of the universe. It seems to have evolved and seems to be rather unusual as far as we know, you know, among planets. But I don't think there's any philosophical problem involved.
Is there any concern about first cause that you need to get into from your perspective, George?
Well, no. I mean, it depends when you're asking me philosophically or scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophically, I don't think the first cause argument holds up. The so-called argument from life certainly does not hold up as a philosophical point. Because there are other objections to these arguments, but it seems to me one of the prime objections, one of the ones most commonly raised, is that the argument always has to go back one step further. If everything must have a cause, and we reach the conclusion that therefore God doesn't have a cause, or that seems to be part of the argument, well, if everything has to have a cause, then God has to have a cause.
Unless there's an infinite regress. Greg Bahnsen, how would you address what Benny has asked here about life?
Well, I think Benny's question's a very good one. See, I would follow it up, George, by asking, is it your belief that life came from non-life, or is it your belief that life is, I think as you were saying, part of the characteristics of reality or the universe, in which case there always has been life, it never did have to come into being, it's always been in being. And then secondly, and I'll be quiet at that point, I think the question of first cause arguments has not been adequately dealt with if you only talk about the overly general approach to the cosmological argument that says everything has to have a cause, and then the question naturally is, does God have to have a cause? A more profound question is, what do we presuppose when we use the concept of causality? And this is going to be a repeat of what George has heard earlier. I would argue that when people use the causal notion or the inductive principle, that they are presupposing a Christian view of the universe, and that's what makes science possible. So I wouldn't argue that you go from cause back to cause back to cause and finally get to God. That's a very, I think, primitive understanding of that argument. But I would argue that the very notion of causality presupposes the Christian God as well. But back to life. Does life come from non-life?
That's a scientific question, and I don't know. My best guess would be that the complex protein molecules that go into the building blocks of life probably did come out of synthesizing processes and so forth. Dawkins goes into that. But again, that's a scientific, not a philosophical question. And I by no means consider it.
But I do think it illustrates something that's very important for your hearers to know, John, and that's that atheists are just as much full of what we might call faith commitments as Christians are. Clearly, they are different commitments, but you have George here saying that he's willing to acknowledge the possibility that life comes from non-life. The next question would be...
I said I don't know.
He doesn't know, but I mean, after all, we have to have some view of life when we talk about that. There's an empty faith commitment here, it seems to me, when you say you don't know. Maybe it did come from non-life. That irrational possibility exists. Did intelligence come from non-intelligence? Did morality come from non-morality? There are always these leaps and gaps in the non-Christian worldview that, obviously, in 2 minutes we're not going to get to the bottom of, but they're worth exploring. So I'm glad Benny asked that question.
Okay, Benny, appreciate the call. Let's go to Garrett, a first-time caller from Costa Mesa. Garrett, you're on KKLA.
Hi, John. My question is for George. The name of his book is what?
Atheism, The Case Against God. That's his first book. His second book is Atheism, Ayn Rand, and Other Heresies.
Okay. Speaking of what everybody's talking about today with evidence, the Bible being our evidence with, like, the appearance to Moses, the history of prophecy and how they came true, the claims and miracles of Christ, and the eyewitness evidence of the resurrection of Christ. We have evidence, but yet I haven't heard any evidence from Mr. Smith of a claim of no evidence against God, the belief in God, or the existence of God.
As I said at the beginning of the program, the atheist is not obliged to prove anything. Atheism is simply the lack of belief. If you do not believe in the existence of magic elves, it's not incumbent upon you to prove they don't exist or to give reasons why you don't believe. If I come forward to you and say, I just saw a magic elf running across the room and disappeared in a puff of smoke, and challenge you to disprove it, and why don't you believe it, you simply say, well, if you want me to believe it, prove it. Or give me some reason to think that it wasn't just a figment of your imagination, let's say.
I think in the history of the vocabulary of atheism, agnosticism, and so forth, that it would be a fair remark, although I have no jealousy for the words. Who cares about the words? But I do think that atheism has not meant what George is portraying. I mean, that's closer to what we have called agnosticism. But it is interesting to me, and I think your caller is on to something that I wondered about, too. When I look at George's book, it's subtitled The Case Against God. He's not saying that there's no case for God, which is the only thing he's done this afternoon, to say, well, you know, the burden of proof is on you. But when you write a book, George, against God, I think you do bear the burden of some proof to show why we should be against and not just neutral on the question.
Yes, and that's what the 327 pages are about.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. I appreciate the call. Garrett, we'll take a break, come back and dig more of your phone calls. Stay with us. We're talking about the existence of God and atheism, the case against God. My guests are George Smith, author of the book Atheism, the Case Against God, and Atheism, Ayn Rand, and Other Heresies. And also Dr. Greg Bonson, who has numerous books and articles out there and is a Christian apologist, taking your phone calls. Before we go back to the phones, George, you wanted to give more or less your definition of atheism.
Well, I've already given it, but Greg raised a point, which is a very common misconception that somehow defining atheism as the absence of belief as opposed to what's called the positive definition, the outright denial, is sort of an idiosyncratic definition. In fact, it's not. In my recent book, I have an entire essay called Defining Atheism. I present, just as examples, 12 to 15 or more prominent atheists who for the last 200 years have defined atheism in precisely that manner, along with a number of prominent theologians, Richard Watson around the mid-1800s, Robert Flint in a very important book on agnosticism, who was a Christian, who simply said atheism is simply the lack or the absence of belief in God. My point is that we should look to what atheists have been arguing for many years and what they themselves claim they have been saying, not to critics who tell us what they should have said.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Max, a first-time caller from Canoga Park, although I think I've heard from Max before. Max, you're on KKLA.
How do you do?
Okay.
George.
Yes.
I've got your book, and it's dog-eared and underlined and highlighted all over the place. I think it's the best book that has ever been written
on
atheism. But the title should really be Atheism, the Case Against the Idea of God.
Yes.
And that's what you meant.
Yeah, there was a little dramatic license taken. That would have spoiled the symmetry of the title.
Right.
So it is the case, it's a philosophical case against God, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And as to this explaining thing, how does one explain existence? To me, that is totally absurd.
I agree. Existence is simply the causal primary. In other words, if you ask for a causal explanation of something, that presupposes something that exists and acts as a causal agent.
Exactly. And all of the arguments for the existence of God presuppose the existence of God. It's question begging.
There's no problem
from beginning to end.
Hold on, Max. Let Greg Bonson respond to that. Good point.
Yeah, I think that is one of the most common and silly arguments against the Christian apologetic imaginable. Of course, arguments in favor of God presuppose the existence of God, just like arguments in favor of atheistic reason presuppose atheistic reason.
Wait a minute, sir. Just 1 minute. There is no reason to presuppose reason. Reason exists naturally.
Oh, it does?
Without reason, we wouldn't be...
Find reason growing naturally? Show me where that is. Someplace in the United States?
Reason?
Yes.
Reason is the human brain, sir.
Oh, it is. Well,
yes,
then what you're talking about is electrochemical processes in the brain.
Is that not natural?
Well, it is natural, but that's not at all what you mean by reason, I assure you, when you talk about the use of the laws of logic, because your brain cells are not being controlled by anything like the laws of logic.
Oh, what are my brain cells being controlled by?
Well, I would argue they're being controlled by God, but that's not the answer you want. The question that I have for you is, if you assume the laws of physics and biology and so forth, I would think that you believe your brain cells are being controlled by those laws, in which case you're not really thinking and making free decisions when you say the things you do, even arguing against God. You're simply the subject of biochemical responses.
Sir, that is not
what we have meant historically by the use of reason.
Sir, as to controlling things by natural laws are nothing more than uniform occurrences that do happen with unvarying uniformity.
Have you ever seen a natural law?
Pardon?
Max, have you ever seen a natural law?
I beg your pardon?
Max, have you ever seen a natural law? Have you ever tasted one, smelt one?
Of course not. The entire concept of a law is totally abstract.
Exactly.
It's talking about direct experience.
Now, can you explain to me how in an atheist universe there are such things as abstract entities?
Come on. Every idea, every thought is an abstraction.
That's right. Every one of them's proof that you're wrong as an atheist, then. How do you account for the existence of abstract ideas in an atheist universe? They don't grow on trees, Max. You've already granted that.
Oh, boy.
Well, now, look. Live by your own presuppositions. That's all I'm calling you to do.
Is God an abstraction, Greg?
No. God is a personal, non-physical being.
He's non-physical.
There you go.
Could be more specific. I mean, non-existence is non-physical as well. So how do we distinguish God from non-existence?
I'm going to hang up, George. Make him explain God.
Okay, Max,
I'm doing my best, Max.
Max, appreciate the call. Okay, go ahead.
Well, obviously you distinguish God, a non-physical being, from, say, the concept of love, or, say, the concept of number, or the laws of physics, or the laws of logic. You distinguish them according to their characteristics. God is a person, makes choices, and does things numbers do not.
He's a non-physical person.
He's a non-physical person, that's right. Well, you know that already, George, so make your point.
I don't understand what the concept person, obviously. In other words, as Max said, there's a question here. You're getting on his case about these abstractions, and you're claiming God somehow explains
them. Oh, no, I don't think there's any problem with abstractions.
But he claimed that somehow the
atheist in an atheist universe. In an atheist universe, what you have is a physical eyeball and a physical ear and, some kind of stuff inside the head called brain.
Okay, now, whatever the... Okay,
what I want to know is where you get abstraction from all that physical particularity.
Let me put it... But see, you're going from the known to the unknown. This is my point.
No, I'm not. I'm going from the known to the known.
However you think abstractions originate or where they come from, how we explain them, I think we can agree we do abstract and we do think conceptually. We know that. Now,
we abstract, is not the issue here. It's accounting for abstractions, which you can't do.
Okay, now, wait a second. But we can agree, at least to begin with, that you and I do not disagree. There are abstractions do exist.
In my universe, it makes sense. In yours, it doesn't.
All right, so at least we can agree that I know what an abstraction is, roughly, let's say. Now, you claim an abstractions need some kind of an explanation. And I say, Greg, okay, what's your let me finish.
Okay.
And I say, Greg, what's your explanation for abstractions? And you say, it's a personal, non-physical person.
No, I think you've mistaken me. You asked what God was, and I answered that.
And I think
we both know what an abstraction is. I didn't ask for an explanation of an abstraction, as though you've got to give me some kind of causal story of where the abstraction came from. I ask for how abstractions make sense, are cogent, within a worldview where there's nothing but matter.
Okay, gentlemen, why don't we hold that thought? We'll take a break, come back, and take more of your phone calls in our final segment talking about the existence of God. Stay with us. Ism, and does God exist? My guests are George Smith and Greg Bonson. Taking your phone calls, let's go to Tina, first-time caller from Covina. Tina, you're on KKLA.
Hi, John. My question is to George.
Okay.
And my question is to George. I was wondering, has he studied the Bible?
That's the question. Okay.
Yes. Well, that's part of the question.
Well, what's the whole question?
We have
to do a short
time. And
the
whole question, it's a tough one. I was wondering what his conclusion is of what he has studied.
What does he think about the Bible? Does it contain truth? Okay. George?
Well, when I was in high school, the thing that really started getting me very skeptical is when I read the Bible from cover to cover for the first time, because like many devout Christians, I'd never read the whole thing. I'd read pre-selected excerpts, primarily from the New Testament, especially from the Gospel of John. And I must say, the Old Testament sense of violence and ceremonial laws, I wouldn't say dissuaded me from Christianity, but it got me thinking, went to my neighborhood gospel supply, bought the Abington Bible commentary, started buying the Interpreter's Bible commentaries, the set, Bible dictionaries, concordances. So in that sense, it was many years ago, but yes, I studied the Bible. And I don't believe everything I read. That's my reaction to it. It has some very nice, I must say, literarily speaking, the Book of Ecclesiastes is a beautifully written in the King James translation, Song of Solomon. So, I mean, it's literature. Some of it is quite nice.
As far as being the source of truth, though.
Well, I mean, there's some decent things in the Bible, sure. I mean, there's some elegantly expressed moral maxims, that sort of thing. It's a collection of books. It's not one book.
Mm.
So some of it I like, some of it I don't.
Greg Bonson, quick response to Tina.
Well, I think her question was really a personal and biographical one for George, and I understand his answer. Maybe I'd say just in favor of the ceremonial laws of the Old Testament, which are often a stumbling point for reading, that in a sense, if you read them as foreshadows of the coming Savior, there's really a lot of beauty even in those ceremonial laws, God displaying outwardly to his people what the Messiah and his redemptive work would be like.
Well, in the King James Version, in the Song of Solomon, during some of the more erotically expressed passages, if you look at the headings, the running headings in the King James Version, they say things like, Christ expresses his love for his church. I had a hard time buying, but that was what the Song of Solomon was really about.
I do too, George.
Of course, yes, a lot of those are post hoc understandings of the Bible that not everyone accepts. Well, we appreciate my guests joining us. George Smith, your books, Atheism, The Case Against God, Atheism, Ayn Rand, Other Heresies, those are available in bookstores published by Prometheus.
Prometheus Books in Buffalo. Yeah.
Great. I want to thank you for being with us. Dr. Greg Bonson, who's with the Southern California Center for Christian Studies. Greg, how can folks contact you if they want to find out about material you have available?
Yeah, they may want to get a pencil. If they would like more material on Christian apologetics and ethics, they can write to the Study Center at P.O. Box 18021 in Irvine, California, 92713. That's box 18021 Irvine, 92713. And they might be especially interested in my debate with Gordon Stein that was held in 1985, I take it, at UCI. And if they will send in $10 to the Study Center, we'll be glad to get a copy of that to them.
And that was a formal debate on the
existence
of God.
That was a formal debate on the existence of God, right.
Okay, so that would be Post Office Box 18021 Irvine, 92713 to reach Dr. Greg Bonson at the Southern California Center for Christian Studies. Well, Greg and George, I appreciate both of you joining us, and I think it was a very interesting, lively discussion. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Great. We're going to break with family.